Virginia? What is wrong with you? Can't you just throw normal parties? If you must have a theme, how about respect for the historical struggle of oppressed minorities, dress code, your face? No one. It fits. I don't understand.
Virginia is in turmoil this week. Its top three officials enmeshed in scandal, governor, lieutenant governor, and attorney general. Two admitted wearing blackface in the 80s. One is accused of sexual assault more recently. So far, no one, including Governor Ralph Northam, is resigning. What a mess. Jamel Bowie is opinion columnist for The New York Times. He wrote about the blackface problem in Virginia and the larger problem of less obvious racism in our country. Hi.
Hi.
All right. So this column you wrote before some of the subsequent allegations have come out, the attorney general, the lieutenant governor. But let's first talk about blackface, the racist history of it, especially in Virginia. Tell us more about that. Blackface, not simply a form of mockery, but something far worse.
It sort of first pops up in the United States in the early 19th century. It's part of the minstrel show, a form of entertainment, a very popular form of entertainment. It is sort of the primary form of mass entertainment in the United States in the early to mid-19th century. It's still popular after the Civil War, but its sort of locus begins to migrate down south. But throughout all of this, the idea was that performers would dress up as Black people, perform songs drawn from African-American musical traditions, but do so in ways to sort of mock, exaggerate, diminish Black Americans as coarse, as unsophisticated, as hypersexualized, as, insert stereotypes. Mm-hmm. And that was the thing that was supposed to be conveyed.
I wonder if you've read the Attorney General's statement, the Virginia Attorney General Mark Herring's statement about it. It seems like he is truly, truly regretful and apologetic, as opposed to Governor Northam, who hasn't really issued such a deep apology. So I just want to read part of it. He says, in 1980, when I was a 19-year-old undergraduate in college, some friends suggested we attend a party dressed like rappers we listened to at the time, like Curtis Blow, and perform a song. It sounds ridiculous even now writing it, but because of our ignorance and glib attitudes and because we did not have an appreciation for the experiences and perspectives of others, we dressed up and put on wigs and brown makeup. This was a one-time occurrence, and I accept full responsibility for my conduct. And he goes on and says he's callous and he had this inexcusable lack of awareness. But the fact that he dressed up like a rapper that he admired, is that different enough for you when you compare it to, let's say, the Florida Republican Secretary of State, Michael Ertel, who put on blackface to mock the survivors of Hurricane Katrina?
Those motivations are different. And I think for the people engaged in them, it may feel different. But for the observer, if I walked into a party and saw someone dressed as a rapper in blackface, my immediate thought would be to ask, so I wonder if this is sort of just like, good faith, he admires a person. I would take it as, on its face, an attempt at mockery, or at least sort of like a disregard for the symbol that the person is inhabiting. It's noteworthy, right, that Attorney General Herring told the Virginia Black Legislative Caucus in the House of Delegates about his photo. And the reports are that the members of the caucus were sort of dismayed by it, both because this is like, another shoe is dropped, and I think both because they weren't expecting Attorney General Herring to have been involved in any kind of this activity. And so I think if your kind of like focus, your sense of which perspective you're looking at is the person engaged in it, then there is a difference between kind of the blatant mockery of the Florida former Secretary of State and someone like Herring. But I think if you take a more global look and look at it from the perspective of the people who belong to the group that is being portrayed, there's sort of no way in which it's all right. And I'll say, in Herring's kind of, to his credit, he seems to be taking forward-looking steps to earn some sort of forgiveness or atonement from people, versus Governor Northam, who first admitted to it, then denied it, and then has been defiant and sort of didn't show any real sense of contrition in all of this.
But you still think he should resign, Herring?
I'm not sure. I think there is a difference in the offense between Herring and Northam. With Northam, that was done when he was finishing up at medical school. So he's about 25 when this is happening. Versus Herring, who by his account was like a 19-year-old college kid. And I'm much more, just for myself, willing to extend kind of the hand of forgiveness. And, you know, you can stay on and as long as you take responsibility and show that you know what you did was wrong and take steps to rectify it, to someone who did something when they're 19 versus someone who did something when they're 25. And by that point, more or less a full-grown adult.
So he would be third in line if the governor resigned. And so far, as you say, he's defiant and is not saying that he would resign. Second in line is Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax, accused of sexually assaulting a woman named Vanessa Tyson, a professor here at Scripps. She says he sexually assaulted her at the DNC in 2004. He was in his mid-20s. He's denied the allegations. He says what happened was consensual. She says absolutely not. She was in tears during this encounter. What do you make of his response so far?
When the accusations came down, he said that the Washington Post had investigated her account and found discrepancies and falsehoods and red flags. The Post disputes that characterization and says it's not the case at all. So I think from the jump, Lieutenant Governor Fairfax's response has left much to be desired. And now he has hired, there was recent reporting I saw, that he's hired the same law firm that represented Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh in his confirmation hearings and dealing with accusations of sexual assault from Christine Blasey Ford. And I think if nothing else, right, that sends a very strong symbolic message. So,
and she has hired the law firm that represented Christine Blasey Ford. So
that's right.
That's interesting.
What it looks like is happening is that everything is going to cancel each other out and no one's going to resign. No one's going to leave office versus if it were just Northam or just Fairfax or just Herring.
Yeah, so still a mess. So all of this that's happening in Virginia, do you think that this is something that is a product of Virginia and its particular history? Or do you think this is something that is a product of our collective history and that this could happen in any state?
So I think it's fair to say that in Virginia, among a particular class of people, sort of elite white Southern men, often from well-to-do families, within the fraternity culture specifically, blackface was a thing people did for kind of pleasure and vicarious experience and racial mockery. And there, to that point, very recently, within the last 15 years, there have been examples of blackface at Virginia colleges among fraternity men, white at affluent universities. So I think there's a degree to which that is a particular Virginia problem. There is an insular culture that goes back many decades that is resistant to kind of changing racial attitudes. But I think it would be unfair to kind of say, oh, this is just a Virginia thing or this is just a Southern thing and the rest of the country doesn't have a problem with it. Every year, typically around Halloween, there are examples of students having blackface parties. And I think that speaks to how racist mockery, how blackface was a national phenomenon that whites across the country at its height observed, participated in, enjoyed these depictions. We're only 50, 60 years removed from when that was beginning to become taboo in popular culture. And so I think it's not a big surprise that this stuff would still exist and linger. I was just looking at a poll very recently that found that something like 42% of Americans either think blackface is okay or don't have an opinion on it. It's just sort of just under 50% of Americans would say blackface is unambiguously wrong. And if you break that down by racial group, right, it looks very different. It's, you know, barely half of white Americans would say blackface is wrong. So this is a national problem. It is directly tied into the country's history with racism and white supremacy. And what's happening in Virginia is like a particularly dramatic example, but I don't think it should be understood as something unique to that state or that region.
Yeah, we were just talking about it in the office, and someone brought up that movie, Soul Man. starring C. Thomas Howell. Do you remember that movie? It was from 1986.
Right.
And it's this white guy who goes to Harvard in blackface. And this is like a major Hollywood movie. I mean,
right.
That could hopefully never get made today, but who knows?
I think in mainstream depictions, if blackface is used, it's often attempted to use in a subversive way, right? So the 2006 movie Tropic Thunder, Robert Downey Jr. is in blackface, but the idea is kind of like a meta-textual joke about actors engaging in extreme transformation to win awards. The joke isn't the blackface. The joke is the kind of actor who would do this.
Yeah.
And that is sort of like smart enough and sophisticated enough that it can pass. But something like Soul Man was not.
No. No. I don't think so.
To put it as simply as I can.
All right. Well, Jamel, it's great speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's Jamel Bowie. He's an opinion columnist for The New York Times. He's here in L.A. tonight. He'll be part of a live presentation of the podcast TrumpCast. It's at 7:30 tonight at the theater at the Ace Hotel. Let's talk more about one aspect of this Virginia scandal, the sexual assault allegation against the lieutenant governor, Justin Fairfax. As we mentioned, a professor at Scripps College here in Southern California named Vanessa Tyson has accused Fairfax of sexual assault. She came forward publicly yesterday with a graphic statement detailing how, she says, Fairfax forced her to perform oral sex 15 years ago. Fairfax denies the allegation. He says that sex was consensual. Ellen Santiago is an investigative reporter and contributor at Heavy.com, and she's written about this story. Hi.
How are you?
Great, thanks. Well, tell us more about Vanessa Tyson, who she is, and how she came to know Fairfax.
So Vanessa Tyson is actually a PhD, so she's Dr. Vanessa Tyson. Mm-hmm. She has degrees from Princeton and from the University of Chicago. She is a political scientist and has been very into politics in California and nationally. So she was working the 2004 Democratic National Convention, as was Justin Fairfax. He was working for the Kerry campaign. So that's how they ran into each other at the convention in Boston in 2004.
And then they became friends, and then they became a little bit more than friends. What happened at that particular moment where their descriptions of the event differ?
So what Fairfax says is that they hit it off, and she was really into him. And what Dr. Tyson says is that they had a mutual friend and that they were very cordial together. They were working together. So right off the bat, it seems like their perspectives on them meeting each other is just a little different. He tells her, according to her, let's go get some fresh air and to pick up some documents. They go back to his hotel room. They had not been flirtatious, she said, but he kissed her. And she said that it was surprising, but not unwelcome. She kissed him back. And what began as a consensual kiss, she alleges, turned into a sexual assault. He says that it was a 100% consensual encounter. And at no time did he assault her in any way. He vehemently denies that.
Mm-hmm. But in her statement, she says she was crying at the time.
So what she says is that he led her to the bed, and then he forced her to perform oral sex, she claims. And while that was happening, she was gagging and crying. And so she cannot fathom how he could think that that was a consensual encounter. And he just claims that it was.
All right. Now, why is this coming up now? He is saying that this is obviously coming up now because he's next in line to be the governor of Virginia should Northam decide to step aside.
Right. So so the Northam yearbook scandal was uncovered and then reported on by Richmond Media. But it was also part of Big League Politics, a right-wing website. And on Sunday, the 3rd, the same right-wing website, Big League Politics, published a Stanford fellow hints at possible Justin Fairfax sex assault. Now, what they did was a tipster, they said, gave them a screenshot of Tyson, a Tyson message, a private message that she shared with a friend, who, and the friend said that she was given permission to share that post. So I think there's a little misunderstanding. I think folks think that this woman, Adria Scharf, gave this to Big League Politics. That's not what happened. So they got it from a tipster, and they ran it. And then it all just started leaking out. And
however, so, but the Washington Post apparently knew about this a year ago, right, and wanted to write a story, but didn't because the paper said it couldn't corroborate her account. How did the Washington Post find out about it a year ago, and what is it said subsequently?
She went to them, and she went to a couple of other media outlets and in the D.C. area, and she also told a congressman who she actually had a relationship with previously. And this is all timed with the election in Virginia when Fairfax was elected lieutenant governor. Mm. So that is in November of 2017. She goes to the Washington Post and tells them in December of 2017 or in January of 2018, brings her story there. Now, the reason they cannot corroborate it, my understanding is that it's two people in a room. So she says this happened, and he said this happened. The Washington Post was careful to point out, too, that when the lieutenant governor defended himself by saying that the Washington Post didn't find anything, the Post came right out a couple of hours later and said that's just not true.
Okay, so as we said earlier, both sides have hired law firms, the same law firms who were hired to represent Brett Kavanaugh and Christine Blasey Ford. So that's interesting. Where does this go from here?
So that's the big question. She said in her statement that was released yesterday by Deborah Katz's law firm, and Deborah Katz was Dr. Ford's attorney, that this was all they were going to say. This was the statement, and that was it. In Massachusetts, where this event took place, according to Dr. Tyson, the statute of limitations on a civil sexual assault case is 35 years. So she could come back and sue him at any point. For criminal, it's 15 years. And she's got, I don't know, 7 or 8 months left to do that. That's the big question, I think, is has she ever gone to law enforcement and is she planning on going to law enforcement? So that's something to look at. On the other side, on Fairfax's side, he's vehemently denied this. He's not going to step down. I can't see it. Perhaps he will. The Virginia Democrats have said that they're going to keep an eye on this, but no mention of an investigation. They're saying that they're going to, quote, evaluate the situation. So I'm not sure where this is going to go.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and updating us.
It was my pleasure. Absolutely. Thank you for reaching out.
That's Ellen Santiago, investigative reporter and contributor at Heavy.com. Coming up, the Green New Deal. It's an ambitious idea to remake the entire U.S. economy. We'll have more on that next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
Climate change and our environmental challenges are one of the biggest existential threats to our way of life, not just as a nation, but as a world. And in order for us to combat that threat, we must be as ambitious and innovative in our solution as possible.
New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez making good on her campaign promise to deliver sweeping climate change legislation today. She's teamed up with Massachusetts Democratic Senator Ed Markey and various environmental groups to introduce a Green New Deal. It is a non-binding resolution that really seeks to remake the entire American economy in 10 years by getting rid of fossil fuels entirely. Joining us now is Ben Beachy, director of the Sierra Club's Living Economy Program, and he's been leading the Sierra Club's work on this resolution. Hi.
Hey there.
Well, what are the major goals of the Green New Deal? How are we going to get to zero emissions in 10 years?
A Green New Deal is a bold plan to tackle the twin crises of inequality and climate change at the speed and scale that justice and science demand. The way we're going to get there is through a full-fledged national mobilization to really help us transition from an economy of low wages and climate pollution to one that's driven by dignified work and 100% clean energy. There's, I think, three essential pillars to a Green New Deal that are really spelled out and emphasized in today's resolution by Senator Markey and Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez. The three pillars are tackling the climate crisis and toxic pollution, creating good, high-paying jobs, and fighting racial, economic, and gender inequity. These are broadly popular goals, and there's a whole swath of policies that fit into that framework that achieve all three of those pillars at once. And so that's really a big opportunity to galvanize movement momentum towards systemic change. So today's resolution, it's appropriately bold. Mm-hmm. We need to think big. We're running out of time. To tackle these twin crises of climate change and inequality, we need solutions that match the scale of the problems.
Yeah. Well, just paging through the resolution, it's short, so it's easily read quickly. There aren't any specifics on how to do that. So when it comes to the sense of urgency, the urgency being we are in, as you well know, climate change right now, global warming is happening right now, why not propose specific solutions that can be enacted soon, rather than just proposing broad ideas?
It's a great question. And the reason is because at the moment we're in right now is a moment of opportunity to build broad alignment behind high-level goals. You have to first make sure that we get as many groups and constituencies and people on the same page on what it is, what's our North Star. What are we aiming for in the end? What do we want to achieve? And then, yes, we have to, in a second phase, spell out those specific policies that are actually going to get us there. And that process looks like not any single person, no single group, no single member of Congress spelling out those policies, but a nationwide, inclusive process to name the specific policies. Mm. I mean, we need to have like field hearings in frontline communities who are on the front lines of climate change and low wages, to say, here's what a Green New Deal means to me. This cannot be a Washington, D.C. conversation. This is a nationwide conversation that should happen over the course of the next year so as to put substance on this bold Green New Deal vision that's just been unveiled, so that if there's a new administration that takes power in just 2 short years, we'll have some concrete ideas ready to go with the broad movement behind them.
So basically, you're counting on the fact that it's not going to go anywhere with Donald Trump as president or with the Republicans controlling the Senate.
I mean, I don't think it's a newsflash that Donald Trump is not about to usher in an economic transformation that supports our climate goals, good union jobs, and economic justice.
But even Nancy Pelosi, Democratic House Speaker, seemed dismissive of this. In Politico yesterday, she called it the Green Dream. She didn't even call it by its right name, and she said nobody knows what it is, and that there are other environmental proposals that she might want to look at instead.
I don't I mean, this is not an exclusion of any other proposals, I don't think. There's this, you know, a Green New Deal really complements a number of the proposals out there for 100% clean energy, for, you know, doing what's necessary to meet our Paris climate commitments. You know, Congresswoman Pelosi certainly been a champion for climate action, and she has actually, you know, if you look at some of her quotes, even just last 48 hours, has, you know, talked about how she welcomes the enthusiasm behind the Green New Deal. And so I think actually there's fairly broad support in a, you know, despite a relatively short turnaround. It's over 60 members of the House, including a lot of congressional leaders who signed on to this resolution as original co-sponsors. Nine high-profile senators signed on, at least nine. And so, you know, this, I think, is only going to grow. We're right now, you know, just launching basically Senator Markey and Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez have delivered a North Star with an already impressive array of support that I think will only continue to grow as we start talking about substance.
Mm-hmm. Well, given the fact that Washington is just so paralyzed, can't really seem to get any legislation happening, why not focus more locally? I mean, California's been doing a lot on this, and maybe that would be more effective in terms of what can actually be achieved.
We have a both-and approach to that. Yes, both. I mean, our vision for, I think the vision for a Green New Deal is really grounded in a lot of the wins that state and local coalitions have been winning over the last number of years, including the last 2 years in the shadow of the Trump administration. I mean, you mentioned California. California enacted a Buy Clean law that was the handiwork of a broad coalition of environmental and labor groups to ensure that California is spending taxpayer dollars on clean manufacturing firms that you know, reduce their climate impacts, and not corporate polluters. That also creates really good jobs. And so that's a model. It's the first of its kind in the nation, and we're looking to such models across the nation and asking the question of how can we scale these up towards a national Green New Deal. So it's not a Green New Deal at the national level is not to the exclusion of state and local policies. In fact, it can be built on a lot of the state and local progress we're already seeing.
So this idea that in 10 years this whole thing can happen, you can be zero carbon, the entire country could be zero carbon, every building would be upgraded, there would be this infrastructure nationwide that would be upgraded so that you could take trains instead of airplanes, et cetera, et cetera. Is that really possible to do in 10 years? It seems like such a short amount of time.
I mean, I guess the question is, can we afford not to do it? I mean, we're talking about two of the defining challenges of our time, climate change and inequality. As you well know, the IPCC put out a recent report saying basically, we have about that 10 to 12 year horizon to be, dramatically cutting our climate pollution. And so what we need is ambition. What we need is boldness. And this is not the first time we're talking about this. In the original New Deal, many of the projects that Franklin Delano Roosevelt laid out, I'm sure, sounded incredible at that time.
Mm-hmm.
When, you know, the moonshot program was first declared, and, you know, when they said, we don't know what the technology is, we don't even have it yet, but we're going to, in a 10-year period, put someone on the moon, it probably sounded, a little out there to some people. But in both instances, we did it. And actually, for most of the Green New Deal, we're not talking about being beyond the technological frontier. We have the means. The only thing that's lacking is political will. And I think this immense wave of momentum you've seen in the last couple of months towards the Green New Deal is a sign that we're starting to build the political will.
Ben Beachy, director of the Sierra Club's Living Economy Program. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, buying a house in L.A. and actually getting a deal.
I thought it was too good to be true. I was like, well, something's off because this is like totally underpriced.
A new way to buy a home. What's the catch? We'll tell you next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. What if I told you you could buy a newly renovated three-bedroom home in Echo Park for around $500,000? Newly renovated, three-bedroom. You'd think, no way, there has to be a catch. Well, there is. You really have to love your neighbors. KCRW's Anna Scott explains.
When Matt Mandarino and his wife were shopping for a house, it had to be close enough to Hollywood so he could still bike to work.
That was a commute I was not willing to give up. So we wanted to stay closer into the central part of the city.
Mandarino works in advertising. His wife designs costumes. They're both 30. They were looking for a two-bedroom, two-bathroom house for $700,000 or less, which is a lot of money, but...
Everything we could afford was in dire need of fixing up, which was really discouraging.
Then they saw a listing for a three-bedroom, two-bathroom apartment in historic Filipino town for $650,000.
And I thought it was too good to be true. I was like, well, something's off because this is like totally underpriced.
Mandarino's wife, Chrissy Callen.
We kept trying to get to the crux of it and thinking like, why are we saving about $100,000 off of a similar condo?
The reason is that the property is something called a TIC, which stands for Tenants in Common. It's a way for a group of people to come together and buy a multifamily building, usually a small one with 2 to 4 units, to save money. Instead of buying a particular apartment, like in a condo, with Tenants in Common, you buy a percentage of the property.
So this is where the original house stopped. You can see
Mandarino and Callen closed on this place a few months ago for the list price, $650,000. It's the bottom half of a duplex, and there's a third standalone unit in the back.
We all each own 33.3% of the property together.
It's cheaper than a condo because you're more entangled with your neighbors. For example, you all share a property tax bill. For Mandarino and Callen, it's worth it.
You take it as a given when you look for a home here that you will need to sacrifice something. To us, putting in more effort to cooperate with our neighbors was a trade-off that we were willing to make more so than a size or location.
People have been going in on properties together for decades, but in the past, it would usually be with friends or family, and you'd all split a mortgage. What's different about this is each owner gets their own loan. So now it's less risky, and you can buy with strangers. If they default, it won't necessarily drag you down. This is new to LA because the only bank in Southern California that does these loans just recently started giving them here, Sterling Bank of San Francisco. Since then, there's been a flurry of TIC activity here.
In the last year and a half, we've brought 9 TIC communities to the market.
Liz McDonald owns the real estate brokerage The Rental Girl and has carved out a specialty promoting and selling Tenants in Common properties.
And we've got 12 units on the market right now.
Still, these projects are a small slice of LA's housing market, in the hundreds at most. But that could grow much bigger if it takes off here like it has in San Francisco. McDonald says that's good news because TICs create more winners in the market.
If you take a 4-unit apartment building and you say, okay, well, typically, historically, this property would have been sold to one person, an investor or a landlord, and now we're selling it to 4 people, and this might be their only chance to buy. The way I look at it is we're sort of spreading equity around to more people.
But in LA, where the median home price is about $600,000, TICs only open the door to homeownership a crack wider, enough to let in people barely priced out or priced out of their favorite neighborhoods. And LA has a housing shortage, so more winners means more losers. In this case, renters getting kicked out of their apartments so their buildings can be turned into TICs.
I have a primo Silver Lake apartment.
For the past 7 years, Mimi Lee has lived in a rent-controlled one-bedroom near the Trader Joe's on Hyperion Avenue. She pays about $1,500 a month, a great deal for the neighborhood.
I'm a stylist. Freelancing is a never-ending project. You're always working on it.
About a year ago, a new landlord, a real estate investor, took over. He bought another property, too, cleared everyone out, and sold off the apartments as a TIC. And within a couple months, served Lee an eviction notice.
I have no idea where I'm going to go. I live here by myself, and I realized it's such a luxury here to live in Los Angeles by yourself.
Lee reached out to the LA Tenants Union for help and found out she's not the only person in her situation. I've spoken to others too, a half dozen rent-controlled tenants being evicted from four different properties by TIC developers. The buildings are in Silver Lake, Echo Park, and Los Feliz, and none of the renters I talked to are facing homelessness, but Lee says that's not the point.
I'm fighting for my apartment for the bigger picture.
The bigger picture that worries Lee and other activists is the loss of rent-controlled housing in LA. Thousands of units taken off the market every year for many reasons. That does impact some very vulnerable people. According to a study by USC, almost half of LA's rent-controlled tenants are at or close to the poverty line. Tenants in common conversions have nibbled away a tiny portion of rent-controlled buildings. But renters' rights advocates say they have the potential to gobble up a lot more.
Essentially, they're ripping rent control stock from the city.
We thoroughly dislike having to evict tenants.
Christopher Stanley is a real estate broker who also consults with investors on turning rental buildings into TICs. The reason activists worry about these conversions is exactly what makes them attractive to Stanley's clients.
It's a really great alternative when you can't do a condo conversion, which most vintage properties you cannot.
Converting a rental building to condominiums is a huge project with a lot of expensive requirements, like having to provide a certain amount of parking, for example. If you're dealing with an old rent-controlled building, by the time you buy out or evict the tenants, do the paperwork, make the upgrades, and pass the inspections,
it's not really profitable for the investor, typically.
But with a TIC, you can evict everyone and then turn right around and sell off the property without jumping through all those hoops.
You could take a fourplex and convert it in a few months if the tenants move. We did a project in 2 months, sold out in a month.
The rental girl, Liz McDonald, says there's not always a loser in this equation.
A lot of mom-and-pop landlords are getting out of the industry. We're seeing corporations come in and buy apartment buildings. Well, now these landlords can sell the building to their tenants.
In some of these properties, people who are currently renting have been evicted in order for the TIC conversion to happen. So what do you feel about that?
Yeah. Yeah, that is the problem with our current markets. When you have a crisis, such as our housing situation, I don't think TIC is necessarily the end-all, be-all solution. But I do feel that a solution is going to be creating more opportunities for people to build wealth.
But until there's more housing in the city, especially affordable housing, an opportunity for one household could mean another one pays a price. For KCRW, I'm Anna Scott.
And joining us now is Warren Almy, host of To The Point, the podcast. Welcome.
Welcome to you.
What's on your show?
Well, we're going to talk about the State of the Union address, and among those people we're going to talk with is Karen Bass, who, of course, is now from Los Angeles and chair of the Congressional Black Caucus. She'll talk about Stacey Abrams in a very interesting way, I think, and so will others. We've got Ron Brownstein, we've got Douglas Brinkley, the historian, and we're taking a look at it. Here was a chance for President Trump to make history, and he's asking for unity in a way that seems designed to increase something other than unity and perhaps continue the kind of partisan gridlock we've had. We're also going to talk, he mentioned, of course, in the speech of the Iran nuclear deal, we're going to talk with Wendy Sherman, who was the negotiator for the Iran nuclear deal.
Which is, of course, now kaput.
It is, but she's going to tell us what it was like to negotiate with these stone-faced Iranians and how at one point she got so angry, she cried.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Tears of anger.
You just got it.
Warren Almy, To The Point, the podcast. Get it where you get your podcasts at kcrw.org or Apple or what have you.
Subscribe.
Subscribe. It's free. Thanks, Warren.
Okay, thank you.
P.E. Love it. Hate it. Let's be honest, most kids hate it. You probably did. So why is it still so horrible? That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
I would just like to say that physical education in this school is a disgrace. I mean, standing in line for 40 minutes is hardly aerobically effective. I doubt I've worked off the calories in a stick of carefree gum.
Well, you certainly exercised your mouth, Cher. Now hit the ball.
That was, of course, Alicia Silverstone playing Cher Horwitz in the 90s classic Clueless. But really, she is right. Lots of kids hate PE. Why? Why is it so bad? Joining us to talk about this is Aaliyah Wong. She covers education and families for The Atlantic, and she wrote a big piece on why kids don't like PE. It's called Gym Class is So Bad. Kids are skipping school to avoid it. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Well, first of all, even using the word gym is controversial. Why?
Right. I think it just kind of conveys that stigma that PE teachers today are trying to distance themselves from. It really kind of simplifies the notion of what this kind of education should entail. It's not just about doing jump ropes and running around the track and wearing your stinky gym outfit. It's about just being active and moving all the time and learning how to integrate physical activity into your lives, or at least that's the ideal.
That's the ideal. But in practice, it really is that same old, where kids dread PE, gym, whatever you want to call it. Why do they dread it so much?
Well, this study was pretty limited in scope. The study I wrote about it, it looked at a program in Texas that made it a daily requirement for middle schoolers, or at least middle schoolers at schools that opted into this grant program to do PE. But the fact that it was a requirement, for one, I think definitely fostered some resentment among kids. I think kids, especially kids at that age, don't really like to be forced into anything on a daily basis. And then similarly, in the fact that it's in middle school, that's a time when bullying is really pronounced. It sees the highest rates of bullying. And it's when kids are getting to know themselves. They're going through puberty.
Yeah, their bodies are changing and they're getting stinky and they're embarrassed.
Yeah.
And then they have to change in front
and
of each other.
Kids are mean. Yeah. So it really kind of creates this perfect storm for bullying, or it really enables that kind of behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And so the assumption is that a lot of the kids, especially those who are subjected to bullying, you know, just decide not to go to school so they can avoid that experience. Or maybe that the resentment they feel of being forced into it, or just not liking the experience, forces them to act out. So this study also found increased rates of discipline problems.
Mm, okay. Well, we wanted to ask some kids here in Santa Monica what they thought of PE. This is at a middle school, and here's what a few of them had to say.
It's not as fun.
It's lots of running.
Yeah.
It's fun when you have friends because you like play games and stuff, but if you're kind of alone, then it's...
Except I didn't have friends, Jazzy.
You didn't have friends. I had friends. But...
I did not.
Okay, so if it's social, they like it. If it's not, not so much. But I wonder if they would say the same thing about just regular class. What is it about PE?
I think PE is unique in the sense that it engages all the senses. It's by definition physical. It kind of makes more conspicuous some of your vulnerabilities, especially if you're overweight or if you're not athletic or if you sweat a lot. I think it's also maybe just seen as an extracurricular, which it is. And so, you know, people have accepted the fact that they have to go to math class. That's just an institutionalized part of their school experience. But PE, not so much, especially when the teacher is maybe not very invested in it or is particularly a bully him or herself, or maybe it's the social studies teacher that's been tapped to fill in for gym class because of limited funding.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then with all this focus on academics and testing, there's been a cutback in PE.
Right. And so we really did see this trend basically around the time of No Child Left Behind, which is the law that kind of spurred that increased emphasis on academics. And that was in the early 2000s. And so in the years since, we've really seen a decline in investment in PE. And in terms of the teachers, I think the population of PE teachers has grown at a rate far lower than that of any other kind of teacher.
Even though there has been this big focus on childhood obesity and this need, at least during the Obama administration, the Let's Move campaign to get kids moving and exercising, schools aren't taking that as seriously as they should?
Yeah, I think they aren't taking that as seriously as they should, or maybe they are taking it seriously, but are simply stretched so thin that it just can't be something they prioritize, especially with all the other expectations, like you mentioned, around academics. So, you know, they have the school lunch program, which has done its part to try to enhance or encourage healthy eating habits. They try to implement these PE programs like the program in Texas, but they're often just superficial programs. They don't really take into account the really holistic needs when it comes to solving obesity. After all, I mean, obesity can only truly be eliminated if you focus on diet as well.
Mm-hmm.
So physical activity can only do so much.
Well, what about physical activity? The study that you mentioned, does it look into how many calories are burned or if kids are actually getting a good workout?
Yeah, so for this study, again, it's based on a specific program, so I can't speak for all PE programs, but this program, just it didn't see any positive impacts on their physical sort of metrics.
So they weren't getting it. They weren't getting into better shape at all, these kids.
They weren't getting into better shape. They weren't doing better in school. That was another objective. And they were having more behavior problems and
because they were skipping school to avoid it.
Yeah.
Because it was so horrible. So I imagine this is not isolated to Texas, that there are similar stories everywhere about PE. Where is PE being done well? And what does that look like?
Yeah, and I don't know if it's so much of a geographic thing, but sort of individual school or perhaps district thing, and, you know, just basically recognizing the benefits of a really well-designed and thoughtful and holistic PE program. So there are programs like Shape America, which really tries to look at the whole child and to really weave physical activity into the entire day that a kid is at school. So they look at recess. They look at breaks between classes to just, you know, get up and move around, especially we have a lot of restless kids these days. They have yoga is being implemented in a lot of schools. So there are, I think, pockets of really great and promising PE programs, and they definitely deserve credits. There's definitely a generation of PE teachers out there who are doing amazing work, and I do want to recognize that.
Yeah, because I guess the ultimate goal is to foster a love of exercising in kids and get them to be lifelong exercisers. And it seems like the traditional PE class does just the opposite. It makes you dread exercising.
Exactly. The kind of old school PE class was just about skill development. So, you know, teaching them how to do push-ups or how to run properly. It wasn't really intended to foster, like you say, these lifelong values. And if we don't instill in kids these values at an early age, you know, that's it's going to be really hard to change their mindsets as adults.
Aaliyah Wong covers education for The Atlantic, and that's where you can read her story. It's called Gym Class is So Bad, Kids Are Skipping School to Avoid It. Aaliyah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, that does it for us here at Press Play. Thanks for not working out with us, listening to the show. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.